Hello and welcome to Happy Place with me, Fern Cotton. On this podcast, we figure out how to live our own happiest lives, shedding the fear of judgment from others. Today, I'm feeling through some of that with Frankie Bridge.
When you have kids, that's the biggest learning curve, is that we don't have that control to make everything perfect. Although I worry about them, it's more about how I'm doing the job. Do they deserve better than me? Would someone else be better at being their mum? You know, I have these real dark days where I say to Wayne, you'd all be better off without me. And then on a brighter day, I know that's not true, but in those days where I'm really struggling, I genuinely believe that that is the answer.
Singer and author Frankie has always been very open about her mental health. But in her new book, Grow, and indeed in this chat, she thinks about how becoming a parent and all the new practicalities and emotions that have come with that have interacted with her existing mental health struggles. I have to say, she did a very good job of making me step back and think about how much time I actually allow myself to claim as my own. Not that much, as it turns out.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And now, here's the show. Hey, Frankie.
Hi.
How are you doing? I mean, we're recording this in the middle of a heat wave, so it's this is a full-on experience.
I know. It's hot. We're so British, though, aren't we? We're like, oh, it's so miserable. It won't stop raining. Now it's too hot.
We're not built for it. We're not built for it. We don't have air conditioning in our homes and stuff like that they do in America, so we can't deal with it.
No, our houses aren't built for it, are they? That's our excuse.
No, it's madness. But anyway, we're going to troop through. There might be sweat dripping from us, but we're gonna have a lovely deep chat no matter what. So this is weird because you can see sort of markers of time with stuff like this. But I spoke to you about a year ago, which is blowing my mind because it feels like it was last month. But a whole year has passed.
I know.
Which is bonkers. And we were talking because you kindly said yes to doing an interview for the Happy Place Festival, the digital one we did last year. And we had such a lovely conversation, which I absolutely adored, and that was obviously sort of near to the, you know, sort of the beginnings of this weird time we've lived through. And it was, dare I say it, almost a novelty still at that point, whereas now we are just like, well, over it, and you know, it's just been all too weird. Mm-hmm. But talking about mentally how you've dealt with the ups and downs and what's been thrown our way over the last 12 months, how have you been?
You know what, like that whole corona coaster thing, I think is just a really real thing. Like, I just have been so up and down with it all. Like you say, the first one really was a novelty. I'd been away a lot, I'd been really busy, and it was really nice to have that moment of just having to be at home and kind of like, I'm not a FOMO person, but also having that realization that everyone is at home and everyone's doing the same thing. It was really nice. And then just after that, I've just found it really hard. I think the kids, trying to explain things to them, and as things have kept changing, that's what I found the hardest. So when it was like, you're locked in, you can't go out, it was very straightforward. The rules were quite, you know, simple. And then I found as things started to change and rules started to go backwards and forwards, that's when mentally I've struggled the most, because I kind of feel like, I don't know if I'm coming or going, if I'm doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And I found that really hard. And having to wait on someone to tell me what I'm allowed to do, I think has been the hardest thing.
Oh my
thing.
God, don't even get me started on that one. That will be an hour-long rant from
exactly.
me that we don't have the time for, or we're not going to bother. But yeah, no, I completely hear you. And of course, you know, when we spoke last year, you were talking all about your book, Open, which is a brilliant account of your experiences of depression and anxiety amongst other life events over the years, which has been hugely helpful to lots of people. And now you've written another book. So you've written Grow.
Yeah.
How exciting.
I know, yeah. I mean, it didn't feel exciting at the time. Trying to write in lockdown was hard. Like, I just was so uninspired, and I realised that I'd written the whole of Open out of my house. It's really strange. Like, I went to coffee shops, or I like forced my, if I had a deadline, I'd have to go and stay away from home for the night. So trying to write it in the lockdown, I found really difficult. And the irony of it was that it was about, Grow is more about my mental health surrounded about being a parent and being pregnant and having kids and stuff. And actually there was nothing harder than, as most parents will know, than having kids in lockdown.
Oh my gosh, so, I know.
Yeah.
Trying to work. I mean, I've had exactly the same thing, you know, just trying to juggle that intensity of the kids being at home the whole time and trying to focus is mad. So, but this is really interesting because, as you've just said, the book there looks at mental health in the context of being a parent. And it's so true. You know, you open up in the book by saying, you know, so often people go, mum and baby are doing well, but, you know, what does that even mean? Okay, right, they're physically okay, and that's amazing, and we're very grateful for that. But what's going on in the mum's head? Mm. You know, you've just been through something so bonkers, being pregnant, or not, if there's been adoption or surrogacy, whatever, but now you've got this huge change in your life, and you've got a kid, and your life's changed overnight, and mentally we're meant to just feel breezy and happy about it. That's what's almost sort of advertised. That, you know, instantly when you become a parent, everything's rosy and it's all wonderful, and it's just so complex. And of course, let's go back to the start, because whether you've had mental health issues prior to becoming a parent or not, you will probably find there are big ups and downs. But of course, you've experienced depression and anxiety since you were a kid. And this is before you even got into the public eye and before you were a pop star, etc. So for people that don't know, at what age did you start to recognise that you might feel just a bit wobbly about life or overly worried for the age that you were at?
It's really hard to put like a proper pinpoint on what exact age, but I was really young. You know, like, I was still, I would say still at primary school when I was aware that I would really overthink things and that things seemed really scary to me that weren't to everyone else. So, you know, like the 6 week summer holidays, the lead up to that of knowing you were going away with the family, I would dread that summer holiday for 6 months leading up to it because I'd be nervous about the flight the whole time. Or my mum used to work away a lot. Every time she left, I was convinced she would never come back. And, you know, like, my sister didn't think that way. You know, she kind of saw things as they were, you know, surface worries type thing. And it just was a kind of almost like a family joke that Frankie was a worrier. And it used to come out in like stomach aches and breathing problems and things like that. And back then, that just wasn't a thing for kids. Kids didn't worry. Kids didn't have anxiety. And it was just, yeah, I was just a worrier.
Yeah. It's so good to hear you talk about it, because, like you say, back when I'm older than you, but back when we were kids, it wasn't really talked about, and it wasn't sort of common knowledge that there were kids out there that felt like that. It was just, you know, you were a kid, you went to school, you played in the park. Whereas now there is a much more open dialogue around, especially now we've got phones and screens and social media to contend with, that we are having those sorts of conversations with kids. And I wonder, you know, in the lead up to this, I was sort of thinking about it, and my own children, who I can see nearing the window right now. Don't you dare come and knock on the window. Of course he's coming in. You okay? He showed me his Pokemon cards. I mean, this is what...
Are they good ones? Are they shinies?
They're called GXs. I don't know what that means. You okay, buddy? I'm going to be out in a bit. I mean, this is what... I mean, it's so relevant that this is happening during this conversation. But, I haven't... So this is Rex, who's literally a foot away from me outside the window. He's 9 next year. Honey's going to be 6 very soon. And I haven't had a conversation with them where I've purposefully sat them down and said, this is my experience of how my brain works, or, you know, whatever language you want to put to the subject on a sort of kid level. I've not had any sort of chat with them about that. And I have a little bit with my stepkids, but only tentatively, because I also don't want to sort of I don't know, be putting things on them that they don't necessarily want to hear right now. I feel really unsure about the whole thing. Have you had any sort of discussions with your kids about mental health, mental illness, that whole subject?
I've never really gone deeply into my mental health. If I've had those days where I can't get out of bed, or, you know, I can't stop crying one day when my depression really hits me, I just kind of say, oh, Mummy doesn't feel well today.
Yeah.
And they both really just accept it, and they kind of leave me to it, really. But I do try to talk to them about their feelings, which all sounds a bit woo-woo and whatever, but I try to do it in a way of, I don't know, just making them aware and thinking about how they're feeling. So often if, like, at bedtime, because I find my kids, I get nothing out of them until bedtime when they're trying to avoid going to sleep.
Yeah. I know this
You know,
one.
You pick them up from school. Oh, what did you do today? What did you have for lunch?
I don't remember. Don't remember.
Yeah, don't remember. And I remember feeling like that. So I think, why do I do it as well? But you just generally, you want to know.
I know.
It's so annoying. So I kind of, I just do this small thing with them where I just say at nighttime, what nice thing has happened to you today? And was there one thing today that made you feel sad or that you didn't like? And they both actually really enjoy it. If I forget one night, they'll be like, Mummy, you haven't asked us about our good and bad thing today. And it kind of gives me an insight into what's going on with them. But also I feel like it makes them have to sit and think about it. And I don't know, like, I don't know what the right thing is to do. Although I've suffered and things like that, doesn't mean I know how to approach a child with those things. But I kind of know if one of them's anxious. So like my eldest, he gets quite anxious about things. He's a real deep thinker. I know not to say to him, it's fine, you're fine. Mummy and daddy are here, you're fine. Because that just, it gives you no reassurance.
Yeah.
Mummy, I'm scared of boats, it might sink. No, you're fine. Mummy and daddy are here. We won't let anything happen to you. That doesn't do anything in his brain to make him feel better about it. So I just kind of try and go, okay, yeah. And I hate that you shouldn't lie to your kids, because I want to say boats don't sink. But, you know, they do, and he knows they do. So it's especially because of YouTube. So I just kind of go, okay, yeah, we know some boats sink, but it's really uncommon and da-da-da, X, Y, and Z. And I try and have conversations with them about certain subjects rather than mental health.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to do the same, Frankie. I think I feel like nervous to start bringing in, you know, my own experience, because I don't want their decisions to be informed by that necessarily. And weirdly, you know, my stepkids are old. I mean, one of them is an adult. Arthur's 19 now, but I mean, I think he'd be mortified if I sat him down and was like, let me tell you about my story. He'd be like, oh my God, please get me out of here. But I think, you know, it's nice to know that if the time was right and they were struggling, that you would be able to apply, you know, not even advice, like this is what I did, but just having an empathetic listening ear, I think is, I guess, the key. And it's really funny because when I was reading your new book, which I luckily got a very early copy of, there were so many bits where I was like, oh my God, we are the same person, because I struggle with so many of the same things as you. And one of them, you've already just demonstrated it. And I do this all the time too, sort of saying, well, I don't know, I'm not sure. And this is what I have. My sort of perspective of life is usually that everybody else knows what's going on and I am clueless and I don't know and I'm wrong. Everything that I do is wrong, and everything everyone else does is a real, like, well, like a concise, well thought out decision. And it's really hard with that frame of mind to trust your own instincts, which is imperative when you're a parent, because you have to do it. So how do you navigate that?
I don't know, it's really hard, because it is that thing, like I said in the book, like it's that one thing when you're about to have kids and everyone says, you just know, it just happens, and you figure that your baby out and whatever, and you think, and the only thing I can liken it to, like I said, is your first kiss. You know, you say to, I don't know if you had these conversations,
yes.
I had them with my sister. Yeah, but how do you know what to do? Well, you just do, it just happens. And you're like, but what if it doesn't? And I think that's the same with having a baby. You're like, but what if I get the baby and I don't know what to do? And I think we don't expect to know what to do when we meet another human being. We don't expect to know them inside out, what they want, what they don't want. So why do we expect that from a newborn? But I think it's been sold, because we've been sold that dream, like you said at the beginning, that you're going to love it and everything's going to be fine. And I don't know, I think it's just, I think you have to be patient. I think that's the only thing you can be, is like patient that it will come, and try your hardest to drown out the the help that you do want and
yeah,
that you don't
the
want.
Noise.
I don't know. There's no answer to it, is there?
No.
It's just,
you
figure it out along the way.
I just had a thought there while you were talking. It's kind of a fine line maybe of, you know, we're not meant to know everything and we can't and we'll make mistakes and that's absolutely normal and it's obviously absolutely fine. But also, we do need to trust ourselves to some extent because when you were talking there, I got a real image of like, you know, if you've got a cat and your cat has kittens or you go, I don't know, to a wildlife park and there's a rhino that's given birth, those animals, without having spoken language, they know what to do. Mm. And the baby knows what to do. It's feeding off the mum or the mum is looking after, nurturing the kitten or the baby rhino or whatever. And I think because there is so much outside noise as a human, we lose it because we're going, oh my God, I haven't read this book and that person said to do this. Mm-hmm. And it's just, and also one thing we should touch on, I'm jumping all over the place here, but this is how my brain's working in this heat, is the judgment. This is what gets in the way of our instinct. Is there any other area of life where judgment is more ubiquitous? It's crazy. Not only about, you know, you talk about in the book some big things that you had to mentally navigate, like making the decision to stay on your medication during pregnancy and feeling shame because of outside judgment. And we shouldn't be dealing with that. We shouldn't be dealing with judgment when it comes to if your kid has a dummy or not, where your kid sleeps, what you're feeding your kid. Like, it's got nothing to do with anyone else. But it's really hard in the moment to feel that and to feel okay about it.
Yeah, it's one of my biggest things with being a parent. And I think it's something that I will never understand is the judgment and the need to judge. Like, let's be honest, we all judge at some point. It's not me sitting here and saying I'm holier than thou and I never look at anyone and think I wouldn't do it like that or I wouldn't do it like this. Why do we have to say it? Why do we have to draw attention to it? Because at the end of the day, all of us are figuring it out as we go along. All of us. No one is the exception to that rule. And some might just handle it better than others. But I guarantee you, there'll be a point where they mess up or they feel guilty or whatever. And I just think, why can't we just look at each other and say, we're all just doing our best. In most cases, your child is at your most important thing, you know, their happiness is at your best interest. So why do we question it so much? I don't know what the answer is to that because everyone thinks they're right and every child is different. And if you have more than one child, you know that more than anyone. You know, my sister's just had twins. They could not be more different. Mm. And they were born at the same time. They have been brought up at the same time. She does nothing different with them. And they are like polar opposites.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
I know.
So why do we think one size fits all? Because it doesn't even for your own multiple children.
I think some of the time if we're really honest, we're just trying to feel better about ourselves, aren't we? We're going...
Yeah.
And also, you know what? I've seen this happen in the context of parenting, but in life. And I've even been dealt this card where someone has judged me so massively and I felt that it's disproportionate to whatever's happened. And I can see they're doing it. And I've done it in the past. We all have. But it's easier to see when an outsider does it to you and flicks it on you. That they're just trying to lessen the mistakes they know they've made.
Yeah.
So if you put more heat on other people's mistakes or judgments or decisions in life, that you can feel sanctimonious for a moment, then it might lessen the heat on your own mistakes, but it doesn't work like that.
That's so true.
Doesn't work like that.
I heard Ramesh talking the other day and he was talking about his kids and they play on Fortnite and stuff like that. They play on the computer and stuff. And he said before his kids were older, they'd been out for dinner with another family and the family was saying, oh, our son is always on the computer. He's addicted and da da da. And he said, we had this real like moment on the way home and you all have done it. We've all done it as parents where you drive home and you're talking to each other and you're like, we'll never do that, will we, babe? No, we'll never do that. Ours will never be like that. Oh, we wouldn't let that happen. We'd do this, we'd do that. And he says, and now here I am, and my kids are exactly the same. And I'm like, that is innocent judgment. You know, they've not said anything to the person or whatever. But it just made me laugh because I thought, oh my God, we all do that. You walk away and you go, I won't do that. 100%
no, because we're just trying to feel like we belong and that we're okay and that we're deserving of being here. I think it goes down to like basic human instincts, like feeling like, we're doing okay. Mm. You know, we're doing all right. I'm safe. I'm okay because I'm making the right decisions. And you say in the book, I've actually written this line down, because you say in the book, when we're talking about mistakes, mistakes are no longer something to be made and then learned from. They're something to be held against us by others, but mainly ourselves. And that is so true, because although we are scared of outside judgment, really, we are, and we know this, we're our own harshest critics, and we berate ourselves for the tiniest things. And when you bring the element of perfectionism into it, which I know is something you deal with, I certainly deal with it. Mine has probably always been there, but also is a reaction to a sort of element of PTSD that now I'm trying to keep everything perfect so that I am safe. You know, like there can't be any room or margin for error. And I'm trying to constantly spin those plates so it's all perfect. And if something does go wrong, I mean, my husband constantly is going to be, what, just calm down, why are you so bothered about that, it's a nothing thing. Mm-hmm. But I blow up these tiny mistakes into something huge because I see myself as this like awful person who's getting it all wrong. And you know, mistake making when it comes to parenting, it's unavoidable. You ain't gonna parent and not make a mistake. No. It's impossible.
Well, if you look through, you know, history, are there any parents that haven't made a mistake or screwed up their kids in one way or another? Like, no. You know, as much as I'm sure you love your parents, you'll probably remember something they said to you once, or this time that X happened. And I'm not saying that that's the reason for all issues that you have in life, but there is going to be something that you do that your kids don't like or that wasn't quite right. And I kind of joked and said, well, then therapists wouldn't have a job.
Exactly.
If that was that, you know, and you look at other family, or you look at your own family sometimes and you think, God, it's quite dysfunctional, or, oh, there's this part of the family that doesn't quite get on, or X, Y, and Z. And you think, and you look at yours now and you go, oh, ours is quite good. And I said to my friend yesterday, actually, I said, I wonder what will happen in our family bubble that will then be that thing where everyone goes, oh, God, yeah, this part of the family, this happens, or I don't know, like that bit of dysfunctionality or whatever.
Yeah, well, it's all changing constantly as people get older and grow and have different experiences, and you can't manage it. None of us can contain that. You can't. You
but
just got to let go,
fear.
Haven't you?
It's the having no control. And yeah. I think when you have kids, that's the biggest learning curve, is that, you know, if you are a perfectionist, like you say you are and like I am, that's a big element of control. It's like we don't have that control to make everything perfect. And I think when you have kids, it becomes even stronger, because you can't stop them from falling over, you can't stop them from crying, you know, there's all these things. And you think, and there is that big realization that, God, yeah, I can't control everything in life. But it's quite hard to accept, and you can accept it in some parts and not in others. And it's funny that becoming a parent is one of the biggest jobs you'll do, yet no one questions it. No one asks you whether you should be a parent. Mm. No one auditions you or interviews you for that role. It's harder to buy a puppy than it is to have a child. So it's funny. That's always blown my mind. I'm like, you know, it's so easy, but it's not, you know.
I know. Isn't that, it's such a big decision, but we often go into it beautifully, naively, I would say. I certainly did. Jessie and I didn't sit down and go, well, you know, what kind of parents are we going to be, and how do we want to deal with, you know, problems that might arise? You just don't. You just, you know, you dive into it. And I think that is the only way, because there's too many, there's just so many things to look at within the family structure and how things might unfurl. And it's all uncertain. We don't know what's happening from day to day. How has that impacted your anxiety that was already there, because you were living with anxiety prior to becoming a parent, and now you've got, you know, this daily element of uncertainty with two people that you love with every inch of your heart? You know, how does that affect your anxiety?
It's funny, because it definitely got better. Like I said, I think it was that realization that, Frank, you can't control everything. Like, look at these two little humans, like, try as you might, they're going to fall over, they're going to cry, someone at school's going to say something to them that they don't like. And in a weird way, that really helped, but it comes with its own anxieties, I suppose. Like, although I worry about them, it's more about how I'm doing the job. You know, do they deserve better than me? Would someone else be better at being their mum? You know, I have these real dark days where I say to Wayne, you'd all be better off without me. You know, you'd have been better off with someone else. And then on a brighter day, I know that's not true, but in those days where I'm really struggling, I genuinely believe that that is the answer. They should have just had someone else.
I know that feeling. I know, and it comes along with, I think, depression probably more than anxiety is a feeling of hopelessness in that situation. And again, like that sort of berating yourself and never quite being good enough. And it's a huge shame because it's a massive pressure being a parent. And something that you rightly point out in the book is that we've talked more in the last 10, maybe 20 years about postnatal depression. And again, that wasn't talked about before then. So there's been progress in some ways, but we don't talk about antenatal depression at all. Ever. Like, we don't hear about that.
No.
And it's because, again, it's advertised as the happiest. You're blooming, you're radiant, you look amazing, you're creating life. But, you know, your brain could be doing God knows what up there, and it doesn't get talked about. So can you talk to us about your experience of pregnancy and what was going on mentally for you?
Yeah, so I think I kind of went into pregnancy with this, you know, I just was like, my body had never really changed. I'd kind of always stayed the same weight. Nothing had really looked much different. And I kind of went into pregnancy quite naively thinking, I'll just be one of those people. Everyone says you blossom and you bloom when you're pregnant, and that'll be me. But there was a bigger decision on the antidepressants conversation before I got pregnant. Like you said, I stayed on my antidepressants and I didn't know that that was an option until that point. And I just remember talking to my doctor and just having like this real honest conversation, and he just said to me, he was like, Frankie, I just don't think you can come off them, because I'd been hospitalized for my mental health before. He was like, there's a real big chance that you will have this baby and you won't be around to be able to look after it. So there are some antidepressants that you can't stay on, but luckily what I was on, I could. But you can't take any anti-anxiety medication. And I really thought that while I was pregnant, I would just be happy, because I'd always wanted to be a mum. I'd always wanted to be pregnant. And luckily for us, it happened rather easily. And then actually, I found being pregnant really difficult. My body really changed. And again, I had no control over it. And it was the first time that I realised that I really controlled my food, and I'd had an eating disorder for quite a few years, and it didn't really become apparent to me. My doctors knew that, but for me, because for the first time I was really hungry and I really enjoyed food, and food wasn't there to just keep me going or something that was a necessity. Like, I really enjoyed it. So I think it was the lack of control during pregnancy that really made me suffer mentally. And I was really depressed. And then the guilt that comes along with that of being depressed when all you've wanted is to be pregnant. It's just like, you know, it's a minefield. And then with my second, I had hyperemesis gravidarum. I can never even say it, and I've had it.
I can't say it, I know.
HG, Kate Middleton has it. That's where you can't stop being sick. And I've got a fear of being sick, and that I couldn't deal with my toddler because I was too busy being sick, and then the guilt of, you know, abandoning him, and just so many things. It was hard. I didn't enjoy pregnancy, and for me it definitely was a means to an end.
Well, and thank you for saying that, because I don't think there's many people saying that out loud, and it's really important, because the amount of people that might be walking around now feeling shame or guilt that they're not just going, oh my God, I'm so lucky and look at me all pregnant. You know, I had, my mental health was a bit all over the place with both, I'd say, and I've probably not really talked about that enough, and some of it was circumstantial, but talking about the sickness element, again, it's not talked about with the sort of capacity for mental health. And I, with Honey, weirdly, I was only actually physically sick maybe twice, but I had high level nausea all day, every day for 9 months. And the first 3 months was so bad, I could barely put the lights on. I couldn't get out of bed. Everything smelled awful to me. I was sort of retching, you know, and it lasted until the day after I gave birth. And at times I felt broken. Like, I was looking at a calendar going, there's no way I can do this for 9 months. It wasn't like, oh, I feel a bit poorly. It was like, I can't stand up. I feel so sick.
And it's that thing of trying to, if you're at work or whatever, having to act like everything's fine.
Everything's fine.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
And another thing that I loved reading about in your book, well, it's a very sad thing to read, but again, it needs to be brought to the forefront of this conversation, is when you look at mental health and pregnancy or being a parent, obviously OCD comes into the picture heavily as well. And there was a stat in your book that 15% of new mums experience intrusive thoughts. And I talked a bit about this on the podcast to Stacey Solomon, who I think she still experiences it now, but has had it. And I had it massively after I gave birth to Rex. And, I, you know, mentally I wasn't in a great place. But then weirdly, I mean, he's, as I said, nearly nine. And I had a really bad episode of this probably springtime this year for about a month. And I didn't talk to anyone about it. And eventually I did talk to a therapist about it because it was becoming really unmanageable. And I was sort of, I could see myself just going down a really slippery path with this one. And it's so common. And at the time you think, God, I'm so mad. Like, no one thinks like this. What's going on? I can't stop these thoughts. I'm completely out of control with it. But 15% is a lot of people.
I know. And I think people don't, like we say, pregnancy is supposed to be this lovely thing that's to be enjoyed. And I think that's why we feel like those things we have to keep to ourselves. You know, even your son's nine, all these things you should be used to talking about now, technically. But we convince ourselves that we're bad for feeling this way, or that we should just be enjoying it all, or we should just have everything together. But that is because that's what society makes us feel. You can't say those things out loud. I hate this whole, I love my kids, but it drives me mad. When my friends say it to me, I say, start that sentence again. I know you love your children. You can have a bad day. You can have a day where you're looking at your kids and you're thinking, I can't do this anymore. You'll have an argument with your husband. I don't think that you hate your husband now.
Yeah, you know, I love my husband, but as if.
Yeah, you don't. You sit down and you go, right, he's a wanker. Yeah. Right? Yeah, do you know what I mean? And it's just like no one blinks an eyelid. But when it comes to your kids, we all feel like we have to defend it before we say it.
There's room for it all. So you weird. Can be deeply full of gratitude, but also really be struggling. You know, you don't have to be just one thing. There's room for it all. And I think that's where the conversation needs to really change. It's so funny, and this is not something, you know, that hasn't been discussed loads of times before, but I think we have to touch on it, the notion of mum guilt. We hear this being thrown about all the time, and we talk to our friends about it maybe, or we hear new mums talk about it when they want to go back to work or whatever, but we still haven't found a balance with it. You know, we talk about it a lot, but there are little solutions. And, you know, Catelyn Moran, who was on the podcast recently, was talking about creating some sort of tax relief for new mums so that they could, whether it's get childcare and have the tax relief from that, or whatever system in place to help them, because there is nothing. And we are just left with this sort of archaic feeling, because for me, my grandmothers didn't work because that wasn't the done thing back then. Mm-hmm. And their mums certainly didn't work. It's quite a new thing that we're going off and, you know, it sounds mad to say that, but, you know, for the most part, to have a full-on career, not just a job that you're doing to help out with the family life, that's relatively new. So we're dealing with that. We're dealing with the repercussions of that and the sort of hangover of the previous generations. And, you know, we're talking about it a lot, but are we getting anywhere with it? I don't know.
I don't think so. I think because we say it quite like, oh, the mum guilt or whatever, you know, like it's
flippantly,
quite blasé.
Yeah.
And it's not. Like, it's really hard. I have friends that desperately don't want to go back to work, and obviously they have to because they can't afford not to, but then childcare is so expensive that sometimes it doesn't work in their favour to go back to work. But then they desperately feel they need that time away, but then they feel guilty about wanting that time away from their child. You know, there's so many spinning plates. There's so many thoughts and feelings at that time. And I genuinely went into pregnancy thinking that I know girl bands don't last forever.
So I was like, we'll have our kids and, you know, I'll stay at home. I've had two great careers. I'll be quite happy to stay at home and be with the kids. And that's just not how it turned out. Like, I just, it's like there's a whole piece of me missing if I don't go into work. And I genuinely feel like it makes me a better parent when I come back. But that doesn't mean to say that it doesn't come with me feeling like I haven't given my kids 100%. I haven't given my job 100%. You know, it's that perfectionism thing again of wanting to do everything perfectly. And we have now been told you can do it all. You can have it all. What if you don't want it all? What if you don't want to have to do it all? And I don't know, it's just, it's really hard. And like, you go into work and everyone asks you, who's looking after your kids?
I know.
Who's looking after your kids? I don't think Wayne's ever been asked.
Of course, no man has ever asked that.
And it drives me mad. It's just those small little things that just reinstate to a mum that they're doing it wrong.
I know.
That they should be at home. That, you know, it drives me mad.
God, it's complicated. It blows my mind. I feel exactly the same all the time. And then that's before we've even gotten to the place where we can think, how would I feel about taking time out for myself? Because mm-hmm. that one gets totally pushed to one side. You know, if I ever say to Jesse, I'm just going to go for a walk on my own for an hour, could be on a weekend or whatever, and I'm just going to listen to a podcast that I want to listen to, I feel like I really need to do this, I have to really feel confident in doing that. Because otherwise the whole walk I'm going, you're a shit mum, who do you think you are doing this? Some people, you know, single parents don't get to do this, you're so... And I just literally beat myself up for the hour and I've wasted it.
Yeah.
So we're even giving ourselves a hard time, giving ourselves a break, like a little bit of time out to just be.
Yeah.
Just to be a human.
It's like we feel bad about doing it, but then, like you say, you don't soak it up when you actually do it, so then it's a complete waste. And then you feel bad that you didn't just enjoy it. And like, listen to yourself. You're talking about an hour third of going for a walk on your
pathetic.
Own. It's ridiculous. And like, you know, I don't feel like everyone feels like that. Like, I know we give men a bad rep, and I don't mean it in that way. Wayne's a great dad, but you know, he wouldn't feel bad about that. And he says it to me all the time. He's like, Frank, why? Just go and do what you need to do. Why are you feeling bad about it? But it's like,
well, because we've been brought up. Yeah, we've been brought up in a structure where women don't have that space.
Yeah, and it's so important.
We don't.
And that's the thing. How can you be a good parent if you're not fundamentally happy or if you're not mentally in the right place to be able to do everything you need to do? And if you're not, you know, you end up snapping at them and then you feel guilty about snapping at them. And also, what are we teaching our kids? We're teaching them, you go to work, you work hard, you come home, you work hard when you're at home, and then you go to bed and you wake up and do it all again. And one of the biggest things I learned when I did go into hospital with depression and anxiety, what was it called? It was something like, I can't remember what it's called, but basically, like, they would give me like a breakdown of my day. And in that day, I had to put in two things that like were like enjoyable or something that were for me. Even if that was like a cup of tea with biscuits or doing some drawing or whatever. And they're like, it's healthy to have these things throughout your day. But I guarantee you, if you asked 100 people whether they have one thing in their day that they take the time out for themselves that they genuinely enjoy, I bet they can't give you anything. And it's so hard.
We're not reaching for joy, are we? We're reaching to like push ourselves
to just get through the day. Like, and that's one thing I learned in lockdown. I was like, God, I wish days away. Or if we just get to tonight, then, you know, then tomorrow we'll do this. And then you get to the next day and you do the same thing. And I just think it's sad. You know, my son said to me, my youngest, who's 5, and he's really inquisitive, loves asking questions, loves learning, but about what he wants to learn about. School, hates it. You know, enjoys everything else. But, oh, mummy, all we do is work. And he said to me the other day, he said, mummy, all I do, 5-year-old issues, is go to school, work all day, come home, do homework and go to bed and then get up and go to school, do work. And I thought, my God, you've got that for the rest of your life. Like, you know, you do it at school and then you do it at work. And I thought, oh, I want to make this easier for him. But equally, I'm like, so I was just like, yeah, mate, you know, we've all done that. I had to do that. And then I go to work. But even as a child, they're aware of that. And I just think, what are we teaching them by not saying, yeah,
go reach for joy.
Go play. Yeah, whatever makes you
reach
happy.
Reach for joy. Exactly. Mm. Do what makes you feel happy. And, you know, even the school system, as brilliant as all of our teachers are here in the UK, the system is still pretty old-fashioned.
Oh, so and I could talk to you all day about that as well.
Oh, I know.
The guilt that gives me sending my kids in, and we are lucky to have that. But, you know, all reaching for that same milestone. We teach them it from a really young age. We all have to be the same amount of good. Yeah. We all have to get to that same point. And I think that's why as adults, we're like, okay, we all have to be the same. We all have to be this good at everything. We all have to reach the top.
Mm, and it's mad.
That's not necessarily what makes every person happy.
No. And if you look at some of the most brilliant people out there that I think collectively we would all admire and say are doing cool things, making a good impact on the planet or in society, a lot of those people didn't even go to university. They're just people that had a really good idea, a lot of passion and drive, and probably more than anything, enjoy what they do. And that's definitely not taught. It's not at the forefront of education, put it that way. And that probably is more our job to encourage that. But it's hard not to, because, you know, I think like that. Most definitely. And I'm constantly trying to encourage, you know, Rex is obsessed with the sea. So I'm constantly trying to get him to the sea, to find sea creatures, to, you know, we've got some amazing beaches in the UK, and to do that as much as I can with him. But equally, I will get feared up like, oh my God, he's not reaching the milestones at school that he's meant to. And his other friends are reading more or whatever. And it's exhausting.
Oh, it's so exhausting.
It's exhausting.
And it gets competitive, you know, my kid's on these spellings, what are yours on? And all this. And I think I could care less what your kid is on. But then I think to myself, don't listen to it. But then I go home and I'm like, my God, he still can't say the. He still doesn't recognise the in the book, you know. And I had a son, my eldest, he had speech issues, he had like sensory issues, and the fact that he now reads freely on his own and he enjoys it, he loves to work hard at school, and he was my child that I worried about so much. And you know, it just goes to show that they're either, you know, they're either that way inclined or they're not. You know, he's had to work harder to get to that point, but he enjoys it, whereas my youngest, he could probably do it standing on his head, but he's not interested.
But also, you know, none of us are set in stone. And that's the weird thing when raising kids. We assume that everything that we're doing as parents and everything they're learning at school is going to be solidified forever in their lives. And if I think about my own life, as a kid, all I wanted to do is dance. I hated reading. I hated it. I would do anything to avoid reading. And now I would rather read than anything in the world.
And you're an author.
And I write books. It's my favourite medium. It's my favourite hobby is to read. I love writing. And honestly, it wasn't until I got to probably 17 when I started travelling on my own that I really got stuck into books. And now, you know, well, I mean, I have to read books every week for work at the moment. But it's a joy always. And I think no teacher would have said, oh, that's what she's going to end up doing one day. I would have been written off as someone that would have just never academically done anything. And I think we've got to take the heat off ourselves when we're parents and go, does this really mean anything when we look at the whole span of these beautiful kids' lives?
No,
they'll make up their own minds as they get older.
And I think
they'll find their own way
to find the joy in the small things. I think that was a big thing that helped with my like anxiety and stuff when they were younger, was, you know, seeing, I know it sounds really cheesy, but I remember just watching my kids on the trampoline and thinking, oh my God, look how happy, like pure joy, like not even just a bit like, oh, this is a bit fun. And like bubbles, how happy bubbles make a kid and how simple that moment is. And I just thought, why do we lose that as an adult? Why do we lose that ability to be able to, I know people talk about it all the time, but to be in the moment and to just enjoy things, because we're too busy thinking about, worrying about all the things we didn't do in the past and all the things we need to do in the future.
I know.
Kids don't have that.
We're so uncomfortable in the moment, aren't we? I'm so guilty of it. I feel a lack of safety in the moment. So I'm constantly going, what's happening next? I need to forward plan. I need to safe proof every moment coming up. And it's it's terrible. When you look at your own kids, and we've discussed this a bit, you know, seeing how different they are in personality, you know, mine are absolute chalk and cheese as well. Can you see, it was weird, I was talking to a very wise person I know recently about this, about what, and you have to maybe think about it a little bit, I certainly had to, what the individual kid, not collectively, if you've got more than one kid, but what the individual kid has taught you or is teaching you. And with a bit of thought, I can see Rex is here to teach me patience, 100%. You know, he does things his own way. I've got to just deal with that all the time. And then with Honey, she's teaching me, I think, self-acceptance. I really get a feeling that she's here to teach me that. She's constantly like very thoughtful of everyone and wanting to make sure everyone's okay, but also checking in with me. Mm. And then with my stepkids, I can see it's been more about receiving love, like feeling okay with the abundance of receiving love. And I wonder if you can see that lesson that your kids have taught you.
Oh my God, it's such a good question. I think my eldest, he's the one that has taught me the most, you know, just how we don't have control over everything, but we don't need to.
He's teaching you to let go.
Yeah, he does. He does teach me to let go. Like I said, you know, with his learning difficulties when he was younger, he's where I would never have thought he would be. Just, yeah, so many little things like that. You know, he's got, and it sounds really silly, he has really bad asthma. We're in and out of hospital all the time. But even with that, I can think I'm so on top of it. And then he has a flare up and, you know, I've done everything I was told to do, but yet we will still end up in that situation. And although they're quite sad things, in a way, it has taught me to not be so anxious about everything because I genuinely can't control it. And he just has this kindness about him that is just so lovely. And then my youngest, like you say, a bit like Honey, he has really taught me, you know, about self-acceptance because he is so his own person. And that's what I love about him. And at times that is a right pain in the ass because you're like, just bloody do what I've told you to do. But I love that. And I really, really don't want that to go because my eldest was, his, you know, he had long curly hair when he was younger and he used to love wearing unmatching trainers. That was like his thing. Went to school, the hair had to be cut off because he wanted it off, and he's quite aware of what he looks like. My youngest could not care less if everyone in the room didn't like him, which in a way sounds awful because he's not mean to anyone.
Oh no, it's great.
But I love that he's like, well, I want to do this. You know, his friends would be like, right, we're going to go and play this. And he's like, nah, like he says to me in the playground, he's like, sometimes I'm just tired, mummy. I just sit on the bench.
Yes, great.
And I'm like, oh my God, as a kid, I'd have been like, no, I need to be involved as an adult, you know. But I love that about him. And that's something that I really want, hope doesn't leave him.
Isn't it weird? We think as adults, we've learned all these lessons and we know what's what. But when we look at how kids behave, especially the age group that we're talking about, because our kids are not dissimilar in age, we've got so much to learn from them, especially with that just being, you know, before they get into, say, secondary school, and that all starts to shift because it's a harsher experience going to secondary school, as I'm sure you and I will have experienced. Yep. But for kids today with social media. But before all of that, when they are, you know, preschool or young kids just doing their thing, they really know who they are and they know what they want. And Rex is very similar to that. You know, he'll wear some very interesting options of clothing or he'll just on a day where he's meant to wear his sports kit, he's like, nah, I'm just gonna wear my school jumper and my school shoes today. And I'm like, you can't, you've got sport. He's like, I just am. And he doesn't care that that's not what everyone else is doing. He feels like doing that, and we get it beaten out of us. Maybe that starts in secondary school. We get it beaten out of us. And it's quite interesting to look back and go, what was I like as a kid? Like, you know exactly what you want as a kid and what you like and how you want to do life. And it gets kind of, yeah, I guess, beaten out of us a little bit.
I think because as well, I spoke to an author, Amanda Prowse, and sadly her son tried to take his own life when he was 19. So they've written a book and they're both in it. So it's both sides of the story. And there's a bit that really stuck out to me where she said she remembers walking along with him one day when he was at like preschool, so like nursery age, and saying like, what do you want to be when you're older? And he said, mummy, there was someone mowing the lawn, and he said, mummy, I want to be happy like that man. And that's all he said. And she said, oh, but you could be anything. You could be a doctor, you could be an astronaut, you could be this, you could be that, da, 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 da. And she says, and now more than anything, I think he's like 19, she said, all I want him to be is happy. And she said, I remember that conversation because I think, why didn't I just say, yes, that's perfect? You know, and I think we feel like we're trying to say, but look, the world is your oyster. These are all your options. Go get them. You can do whatever you want. But maybe just saying, yeah, do whatever. Whatever.
Do whatever.
Yeah, just be happy.
Do whatever. I know it's so hard as a parent not to let the fear in, isn't it? The fear of not only the things we've talked about, not doing what we believe is our best, or giving our kids, you know, a plethora of options as to what they can do and be, but also, you know, how much are they achieving? How much are they pushing themselves? And I think we feel a bit scared about that we're not giving our kids like the best life, mm-hmm. rather than a happy life, maybe, but also an interesting life. And, you know, you and I are very lucky that we've had interesting lives. And I don't mean that because we're in the public eye, or, you know, you're a pop star or whatever. I mean it because there have been some massive ups and huge downs. And that's something to learn from, and that's something to work with, I guess. Mm. And that is one of the things that helps me sometimes, I guess, alleviate that fear a bit. It's thinking all of it's okay. There's room for all of it, because we've got to go through this sort of crazy roller coaster to figure it out. We won't ever figure it out, but to keep trying to work out what this life is all about.
It's scary to let your kids do that themselves. I think we want to protect them so much. And I think if anything, COVID's kind of shown us that we can't really do that. Like, no, I remember my kids going back into school and me saying, oh, there's this really nasty germ. Some people get better and some people don't. And I kind of left it as that. And then they came out of school when they were allowed back at school, and they were like, it's COVID, Mum, and it's COVID-19 and it's a really bad virus and all this. And I thought, you know, like, I can't protect them from everything. You know, like you say, they're going to have ups and downs like we did. And I think we feel like we have to expose them to so much when they're young, and they have to figure out so much already. When you look back at your life, you hadn't figured everything out. Like you say, we're still figuring it out. You
know, God,
people
absolutely.
Say to me all the time, oh, do the boys play football? Are they really sporty? Are they really musical? And I'm like, no, I don't know. My kids are the only two kids at their school. This isn't even a lie. At their last school, they were the only two kids in their year groups that didn't play football after school.
What does Wayne think about this?
He does not care, because he's I didn't even start playing until I was seven.
Yeah.
He turned down his first opportunity to go and play for someone or whatever because he liked playing with his mates. And people are so obsessed with getting their kids into things. You know, clubs are great, and we're lucky that we have them, and some people need them so they can work and whatever.
Oh, Frankie, I've got to be honest with you. I find them fucking stressful.
Mine don't do anything.
Not mine.
I almost wish they would.
No, mine don't. Mine did swimming, and then when they learned to swim, I was like, okay, they can swim now. That's great. They both hated going to swimming lessons. Honey did ballet for a bit, but sometimes because of the traffic, we missed the start of it, and then we can't get in. And I'm trying to get a ballet kit on in the toilet of the local bakery, and it's like, what are we? And she's going, oh, Mummy, you're rushing me. And I'm going, why am I doing this?
And that's kind of the thing, you know, sometimes I have times with my kids where I think, should I be making them do more, you know, because other parents are, and should I be, you know, pushing them to do it? And I always struggle with that fine line, Fern, of like encouragement and pushing.
Same.
You know, like my son, they had the option to play an instrument next term. Carter said he didn't want to do it. I put him down because it was while he was at school for a tryout. So it wasn't like I was signing him up to it. Loves the piano, really wants to play it. Great. The minute he doesn't want to play it, he won't play it. But then where is that? No, you've committed to this. You need to stick to it.
I don't know. I wish I knew the answer.
I don't know.
The only piece I can find in it is, I'm pretty sure that back in the day when like Einstein was floating about, or David Bowie, that David Bowie wasn't at like eccentric music club, and Einstein wasn't going to like extracurricular maths and science. Like,
no,
I think you
true.
Just
it's
find
true.
Your thing. But like, this is a really modern day concept that kids have to go to like eight clubs a week, and then they're going to excel at one of those things. They might end up hating all of it and becoming a landscape gardener. I mean, who knows?
You know, as like a child, you know, being at stage school and stuff and going for auditions and things, I saw so many kids that didn't want to be there.
Oh, and they're stressed out.
You know, and you know, even people say to me, oh, you should get the kids into modelling, you should get them into this. And I was like, no, because that's stressful for me. My kids are being paid for a job that they've been booked for, and that day they don't fancy it.
Yeah.
I am not going to stand there like stressed, because also being from that background of thinking, oh my God, they just want to smile. Or, you know, we did one thing with them and they didn't say the right thing when they walked into the room, and they made them do it times. And in the end I was like, hey, you're not going to get anything from them. This isn't their thing. Like, this is not who they are.
No.
And I'm not that parent that's going to stand there and be like, you know, you have to do this.
It's quite liberating talking about that, isn't it? I remember talking to one other mum a while back who went, oh no, my kids don't do clubs. And I was like, what? It like gave me permission to go, oh my God, I don't have to do all this crazy rushing around after the school run. And I think we've just got to, what we've got to do is just, it's the judgment thing, isn't it? Lose the judgment, do our own thing. We've got to really, like we said earlier, maybe just be inspired by our kids and just do life our own way without all the out, because they're not listening to outside noise.
And that's what I was going to say. I think we forget to look at our kids and think, right, what is it that you want? What is it that you're telling me? And again, I feel like that sounds a bit, you know, if you said that to an older generation, they'd be like, they're a kid, they do as you tell them to do.
Yeah.
Which in, you know, some parts of life is totally true. Eat your broccoli. It's good for you.
Please eat the broccoli, please.
But even that, I'm like, oh, you'll eat it at some point.
I know.
But yeah, I just think we look too much at ourselves and too much at everyone else. And actually, the only people we really need to be looking at is them. But it's easier said than done.
You're so right. You're so right. That's a perfect note to finish on. That's absolutely what we need to do. And give ourselves a bloody break.
Oh, I know. Fern, go for a 2-hour walk, you crazy cat.
I know. I might after this. Hello, Jessie. Just popping out to get my nails done and have a walk. Thanks very much. I love catching up with you. It's been so nice talking again. And it's such a brilliant book. And it's so refreshing to talk about and to read about in this book. Mental health in the context of pregnancy and having a newborn and parenting. It's so complex and there's so much to say. And in the same structure that you did with the last book, having that sort of expert-led, not only advice, but sort of analysis on what you're saying, I think is really cool. So thank you for writing it. And it's been so lovely to talk today.
Thank you.
Frankie, oh, thank you so much for packing that chat with so many really candid stories, but also very practical parenting tips as well. I got so much from it. The main headline obviously being that you know yourself and your kids best. You do. Frankie's book Grow, Motherhood, Mental Health and Me is out right now. And as we mentioned, it's part narrative exploration and part first aid manual for parents. And it's a real eye-opener. You're going to love it. Do get your hands on a copy if you can. If you want to hear more in-depth chats about intrusive thoughts and catastrophizing, you can always go back and listen to the episode that I mentioned with the lovely Stacey Solomon. That's in our archive. And following the Happy Place podcast feed, we'll make sure you don't miss any future episodes. So go follow us on Instagram. Thank you. A massive thanks again to the lovely Frankie Bridge, to the producer, Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you, lovely lot. I say it every week and I mean it from the depths of my heart. Thank you for listening. You're brilliant. As always, I'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.